This is the Takeaway Podcast for Tuesday, November 28th, 2017.
This is the Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you for joining us today.
For the first time in history, we put in place a consumer watchdog, someone whose only job is to look out for the interests of everyday Americans.
That was 5 years ago, January 2012. President Barack Obama stood before a roaring crowd in Shaker Heights, Ohio, and announced the appointment of Ohio native son Richard Cordray to run the brand new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Today, I'm appointing Richard as America's consumer watchdog. And that means he is going to be in charge of one thing: looking out for the best interests of American consumers.
The watchdog there, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, rose out of the financial collapse of 2008. The job was to dive into the fine print of credit card agreements and banking terms of service written by banking corporations to protect consumers. But now the agency is in turmoil. Richard Cordray announced that he was resigning from the agency last week, heading home to Ohio to run for governor. And now is the showdown. Cordray promoted his chief of staff, Leandra English, to acting director of the agency. President Trump said no, and he named Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney as acting director. Sunday night, English sued, saying she was the rightful consumer watchdog. And on Monday morning, Mick Mulvaney, who voted as a congressman to abolish that very CFPB, showed up with a bag of donuts for employees on his very first day. Pete Schrader is a financial reporter for Reuters. He's been reporting on the CFPB since it came online. Pete, thanks for being on The Takeaway.
My pleasure.
It's Mick Mulvaney. It's Leandra English. Pete, who is the rightful watchdog at the CFPB?
That is the question, isn't it? Ever since Friday night, as you noted, that's been swirling around this government agency. We've never had a transition of power at this agency before. Richard Cordray was the only director that agency had ever known. And now we have a legal fight on our hands as the courts are going to have to try to figure out who is actually in charge of this going forward.
So Leandra English has sued. I mentioned that just a moment ago. The president says it's Mick Mulvaney, his budget director. The law does have something to say here. What does Congress say?
Congress depends on who you ask. If you ask the Republicans, they're eager to get a Republican in charge of that agency, which they've long complained is too powerful, doesn't have enough checks on its authority, and they're eager to get somebody like Mulvaney in there to kind of right the ship as far as they're concerned. You talk to Democrats, they insist that English is clearly the legal director of that agency until President Trump nominates a full-time director to take that role, and they're eager to continue that fight. Elizabeth Warren is out there making the case. She helped set up that agency, and she's out there making the case that English should be the person in the director's seat right now.
Okay, but this isn't just all rhetorical, because when Congress passed Dodd-Frank, the banking regulations law, and it was signed into law, they did have language in there that defines who takes over in the event of a vacancy, right?
That's exactly right. The big question swirling right now is over which law do you look at in when it comes to filling this role. Democrats who support English, they point to Dodd-Frank, which established the CFPB. And the language in there does include some language outlining what a deputy director of the CFPB should do. And that's what role English occupied when Cordray put her there Friday night just before he announced his resignation. The deputy director is supposed to serve as acting director in the cases of a, quote, absence or unavailability of the actual director. So they argue when Cordray resigned, that means that she immediately steps up into the number one role, having been the number two role. But what you hear from Republicans and what the argument the White House is making is they're pointing to a different law, the Federal Vacancies Act. Back in 1998, that law was passed, and it gives the president power to fill vacancies that emerge at government agencies. And what they point to there is language that says that the president has the authority to name an acting director of an agency when that person dies, resigns, or is otherwise unable to perform their function. So really what we have here is two competing laws, and depending on who you want at the CFPB, you point at one of those laws and say, well, clearly, we're in the right here, and we have the right person for the job.
Republicans in Congress have had this agency in their sights. Most federal agencies don't attract this kind of attention. Why all the excitement?
That's precisely right. I mean, this has been a partisan hotbed from the very moment it was created. Republicans from the very beginning, they opposed its creation when they were talking about doing it during the Dodd-Frank Act. They've opposed getting Cordray in the director's position. They've opposed the agency pretty much every step of the way since then. The crux of their argument is that it's poorly set up, that the agency has too much power. It has unilateral authority to step in and ban certain types of financial products. They basically argue that that's not the role for the government. They insist that the market should be able to have a role in that, that private companies should have some leeway in terms of how they go about conducting their business without a single government agency stepping in and saying, no, 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 you can't do that. And along the way, you've had Democrats who insist that this is a critical lifeline for consumers. They argue that there's never been a devoted consumer watchdog at the government making sure that consumer protection laws are being adequately enforced when it comes to financial products and financial contracts. And so they argue that this is a much-needed lifeline. And this is just the debate we've been having for almost a decade now, ever since it was first created.
Well, remind us what the CFPB has done during that decade. I mean, what enforcement actions has the agency taken that banking corporations don't like?
The CFPB under Cordray established itself as a fairly aggressive regulator. They drafted a lot of rules that the industry is hotly opposed to. They just recently finalized some rules before Cordray left that cracked down significantly on the payday lending industry, those short-term high-interest loans that you see out there. And people may remember that there was a fight in Congress about a month ago over that mandatory arbitration language that is often included in financial contracts. It was a big controversy after the Equifax data breach broke out. Basically, that's contractual language that stipulates when you sign it, you can't file a class action lawsuit against a company if you feel like you've been done wrong. You have to go to an arbitration agreement. Consumer advocates say that that was just an unfair arrangement. It prevents consumers from being able to go to court. But ultimately, the CFPB wrote rules banning that sort of practice. But then Congress, led by Republicans, stepped in and they actually threw away that rule using their authority. So that's another example of a place where the CFPB has been quite active. And then you can even go back to the Wells Fargo fake account scandal. The CFPB was there as well. They fined the bank about $100 million when that first came to light, and they were really the lead federal regulator on kind of cracking down on that as well.
So the CFPB has been a particular obsession of banking lobbyists over the last 10 years, Republicans over the last 10 years as well. Voters, on the other hand, have voters ever shown signs of clamoring for the CFPB to be reined in, or is this a particular problem at the nexus between Washington and Wall Street?
It's very much a Washington Wall Street problem. You know, a government agency doesn't typically rise to the forefront of thoughts of the average American. But when there has been any sort of polling or any sort of opinion testing on the CFPB, it does fairly well across the board, both with Republicans and Democrats. Generally speaking, it seems like the public is pretty much in favor of having a consumer regulator in position. But then the argument becomes, how exactly do you go about running it? So if you look at what Mick Mulvaney had to say yesterday, he doesn't say that the agency shouldn't exist anymore, even though, as you noted, he's opposed its creation in the past. But now it's all about, how do we make it work better? How do we make it an effective regulator without hindering the private industry? And so this balancing act is the conversation going forward.
Do we know what that would mean? I mean, do we know what a CFPB would look like under the vision of Mick Mulvaney if indeed he stays on as director?
It would be dramatically different than what we saw under Richard Cordray. Already, Mulvaney has announced that he's freezing all kind of ongoing work projects at the CFPB, whether that's rules that they're writing or enforcement cases that they may be pursuing. He's also freezing hiring on it at that point. And you can generally expect that it's going to be, we've never seen what a Republican CFPB looks like. It's only ever operated under the Obama administration. And so this idea of having a consumer watchdog that is simultaneously aware of and willing to kind of listen much more to industry concerns about how they should be regulated, it's going to look significantly different than what we saw before. Fewer enforcement cases, less dramatic enforcement cases, less restrictive rules. Those are all sorts of things that we could probably expect from the CFPB under Republican chief.
And Pete, what about Richard Cordray's political future here? Some in Washington suspect Cordray of sort of setting up this fight that would help propel his likely run for governor in Ohio, get him some publicity.
You know, that's a good question. I think Cordray had announced that he was going to resign a few weeks earlier. It was Friday that he formally announced that he was actually going to leave that day. But the questions about whether he's going to run for governor have swirled around him for months. You can certainly point at the fight playing out now and argue that it's certainly a way to push the CFPB and Cordray's work there into the headlines. It's getting more attention than it ever has before. So what we really have here is this ongoing debate about It's a temporary fight, really. I mean, at the end of the day, the president is going to nominate somebody of his choosing, and the Senate will almost definitely confirm that person to lead the agency full time. So what we're really having now is a temporary fight over a temporary director. And if you're a Democrat, you have to be happy that the CFPB is back in the headlines. And if you're a Republican, you're just trying to get through this fight.
And Pete, before we let you go, we should put a finer point on that, because for all of the controversy and the drama and the showdown that we're part of here, I admit, President Trump could put an end to all of this. He could formally nominate somebody, send them to the Senate, somebody who could get confirmed, and take all of these questions about who's set to run the watchdog, take them right off the table. Why doesn't he just do it?
That's an excellent question. One of the challenges, if you're in the administration, is you didn't know when Rich Cordray was going to leave. He had a term that would run up until July of next year. A lot of people expected he would resign before that, but he kept his cards pretty close to the vest, wasn't going to tip off the administration when he might be heading for the exit. So now we're in a position where we have this drama playing out at this regulator, and the administration basically has to hurry up and maybe get a nominee in place so they can put this thing to bed.
Drama and regulator said credibly in the same sentence. That's Washington, D.C. today as the drama unfolds at the Consumer Watchdog CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Pete Schrader, financial reporter for Reuters. Thanks so much, Pete.
Thank you.
And coming up, more of our series this week looking at the future of the Democratic Party. We have a conversation with the first African-American openly transgender woman elected to public office in the United States. Andrea Jenkins considers herself an independent, but she ran with the Democrats and could be a defining face of progressive politics for years to come.
I think there are some challenges and some issues that we need to face and really address in terms of building this broadest tent that we can and making sure that all voices are heard and are a part of the process. And so, you know, I feel like the people who have been showing up consistently in majority numbers for the Democratic Party have been Black women. And that needs to be centered and elevated to a level of leadership. And when that happens, I will absolutely proudly wear a D.
Well, we're looking at the Democrats this week, the Republicans next week, and you've been telling us what you want to see from the future of your party.
I'm Emma Stamos from Colerain, Massachusetts, and every day I hope and pray that the Democratic Party will become more and more progressive, especially as the millennials get more and more mature and active in politics.
Hi, my name is Martin Hest. I'm calling from Richardson, Texas. I'm really interested not in what the parties look like in 20 years, but what the parties think America should look like in 20 years. I just don't get any sort of idea of what they want. Other than, you know, maybe the next 6 months out, maybe the next legislative push. But 20 years from now, what does America look like? Tell me, Democrats. Tell me, Republicans.
Martin is looking for vision, not snapshots from the political parties in America. We want to hear from you and know what you think as well. 8778-MY-TAKE. We have a lot more with Andrea Jenkins from Minneapolis coming up next. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time. And Westridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, aspiring to help men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders with a family-centered integrated treatment approach. More at westbridge.org.
Thanks for being with us here on The Takeaway today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This week and next week, we're looking at the future of the political parties in America. This week, it's the Democrats. And yesterday, I sat down with Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who isn't a Democrat, but nevertheless is having a huge impact on the Democratic Party. Well, today we go to a new face in progressive politics, Andrea Jenkins. Jenkins was elected to the Minneapolis City Council earlier this month, and when she won, she became the country's first openly transgender African-American woman elected to public office. Jenkins ran under the Democratic banner. In Minnesota, they're called the Democratic Farm and Labor Party, or DFL, but in reality, she's an independent. Jenkins was also endorsed by Our Revolution. That's the political organization spun out of Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. Well, Jenkins coasted to victory in the 8th Ward of Minneapolis with 70% of the vote, and she got national attention when she did it. I talked with Andrea Jenkins about the face of the Democratic Party and how she thinks that face needs to change to broaden Democrats' appeal.
From day one in our campaign, you know, I talked to my team. It's like, yes, we must get me elected. Like, that is our primary and ultimate goal. But we want to build for 2018. We want to build for 2020. We want to build, you know, political operatives and give young people the opportunity to learn some of these positions and develop those skills that are going to help them engage in electoral politics in the future. 2018 is critical. We must win back House seats. We must win back congressional seats. And we absolutely must win on the local level, too.
Andrea Jenkins, I should ask, you were backed by Our Revolution, the political arm, what came out of the Sanders campaign. Are you a Democrat?
Well, you know, this is how I answer that question, Todd. I received the DFL endorsement, which is the Democratic Party here in the state of Minnesota. I have voted Democratic in many elections, but I also have voted for Green Party candidates and independent candidates. So I consider myself an independent, but very much in line with the goals of the Democratic Party, and have supported and will continue to support Democratic candidates in the future, if they are the right candidates. I vote for the person, not the party.
Now, see, this is a tough one, and you see where I'm going with this. We talked to Bernie Sanders at the start of our series on the future of the Democratic Party. And Andrea Jenkins, the reaction I got on Twitter from Democrats, why are you talking to Bernie Sanders about the future of the Democratic Party? He's not a Democrat. That's disregarding the obvious influence that he's having on the party. You're an example of that influence, but the question is the same. Why should people be talking to you about the future of the Democratic Party if you're not a Democrat?
Wow. Well, I absolutely uphold the values of the Democratic Party because they are my values. You know, I think there are some challenges and some issues that we need to face and really address in terms of building this broadest tent that we can and making sure that all voices are heard and are a part of the process. And so I think people have to understand that just because folks don't wear the label doesn't mean that they don't uphold the values of the Democratic Party.
You said there are a lot of problems in the Democratic Party. Let's diagnose. What are they?
Well, I think we are witnessing sexism as a challenge in the Democratic Party, as well as racism. Those issues are not being elevated to the level of conversation that I think they should be in terms of electoral politics. There's this big sort of debate about who should be the target of Democratic efforts. I feel like the people who have been showing up consistently in majority numbers for the Democratic Party have been Black women. And that needs to be centered and elevated to a level of leadership. And when that happens, I will absolutely proudly wear a D.
We'll talk about what it takes to get those women to those positions.
Well, I think we need to provide training for those women on how to run for political office. And then once we get them to that point, we have to vote for them. We have to support them with our actions. And it's been quite interesting to me, and I'm going to delve into some really deep water here, but, you know, there's been a huge mantra, and rightfully so, listen to women. Me too, hashtag me too. I want to say, listen to Black women. Black women voted overwhelmingly 93% for Senator Clinton to become the first woman president. And a majority of white women either stayed home or voted for number 45. That has to end. Black women have been on the receiving end of all the oppressions of racism, of sexism, of wage discrimination. We didn't listen to Anita Hill when she was saying that, you know, this sexism was an issue. So, you know, I think we really have to begin to uplift and center the voices of the most marginalized people in our communities. And when that happens, I believe that we all benefit and grow.
There's a tough question embedded at the center of what you're arguing for, Andrea Jenkins. A lot of Democrats say that for a candidate like you to compete on a national level, let's say economics, wages, kitchen table issues, absolutely. But a lot of those same Democrats warn that a Democratic Party too heavily identified with social causes, with gender issues, LGBTQ rights, is going to turn off a lot of traditional voters when you get to a general election. Politics can be kind of a cold, calculating game. Is that a danger?
Well, I think it's only a danger if that is the only issue that you are addressing. I look at all of those things in a intersectional context. We can't have economic fairness if we still have sexism and racism and homophobia and transphobia. Those things have to be addressed in order to have the broadest impact on affordable housing, on access to affordable health care, access to living wage jobs. That was kind of my own concern with the Sanders campaign, is that it talked about those sort of bread and butter issues, as you framed it, but it left out all of the activism around LGBT rights, around dismantling racism, dismantling sexism. And as we can see, just by turning on any news outlet, those issues are not going away. They are front and center. And in fact, they are intensifying.
Let's talk about those things at the top of the party right now, Andrea Jenkins. A lot of Democrats were angered over the weekend when Nancy Pelosi, the House Democratic leader, went on television and chose not to condemn Congressman John Conyers from Detroit, accused by several women of sexual harassment. She chose not to call for his ouster. She chose not to condemn him. He since stepped down from his leadership post on the Judiciary Committee. How did you interpret Nancy Pelosi's choice there?
Well, you know, I thought that it was to let the ethics investigation take place and then deal with the outcomes of that. I think we have to investigate every accusation individually. We can't just take the accusation and declare the person guilty without having some formal process. In my mind, that is antithetical to justice.
But can the Democratic Party maintain its high ground, its ownership of equality issues for women, if members of Congress like John Conyers, if senators like Al Franken from your own state of Minnesota don't resign? A lot of Democrats have said these men need to go for the good of the party and for the good of the party's message when it comes to women and the treatment of women.
Okay, that is a very, very, very big question. It's shocking to me that just 1 year ago, we elected a president who says, grab them by the genitals, you know, you can do it when you're a star. 53% of white women went out and voted for this guy. Less than 9 months later, then we have all of this Me Too stuff. And you absolutely know many of those women who are stating that they have been harassed voted for him. So we're in sort of an existential crisis in our country. Absolutely, we need to hold people accountable for their actions, particularly when it comes to harassment, abuse. But I don't think that we absolutely just rush to judgment in every single case. We have to look at the issues fully. And that is, in my opinion, how you maintain a moral high ground, is that you give everybody a fair investigation into the allegations. And if they prove to be wrong or malicious and harmful, then they need to be addressed at that time. And absolutely, if that's the issue with Congressman Conyers, who I have deep respect for, Senator Al Franken, whom I have great respect for, if they are found to be guilty of these allegations, absolutely they should step down.
Well, Andrea Jenkins, it took many, many years for the Democratic Party to get hollowed out on the local level. People say that you're part of the recovery now. I guess we'll see if that's true. When you look at the profile of the Democratic Party, the people on the councils and the offices of the Democratic Party, or even the candidates, what should the party look like in 2020?
It should look multi-issue, multi-racial, multi-gender. I would love to see folks in office like myself who have been endorsed by Our Revolution, which I am deeply proud of, and the DFL, which I am deeply proud of. We have to begin to build bridges between those two, I hesitate to use the word factions, but that's probably the most accurate description I can come up with at the moment, and bring those two groups together, those two actually really powerful forces. Our Revolution really did a tremendous job at engaging younger people who had not been sort of actively engaged in electoral politics. They had been engaged in sort of activism and Black Lives Matters and bringing them into the political process, which is amazing. And we have to build a bridge across those two factions.
You know, if those bridges are built, Andrea Jenkins, between the Our Revolution faction, the progressives, the women of color, the transgender women, all of those different factions that you talk about, and the traditional Democrats, who many of them are people of color too, we can't simplify it that much. The warning, as you know, is that you can do that if you want. You can pull the party to the left, and you can turn around and turn off a lot of moderate white Democrats in places like Pennsylvania and Ohio.
I can't say yes or no that that would happen. I do know that when we can achieve fairness and equity and equality for the marginalized people in our culture and society, and if that means pulling us to the left, then, you know, I know that when that happens, everybody benefits. That's the key to my political life, is to try and help improve people's lives. That's the work that I think myself and all politicians should be pursuing. That doesn't leave people out. That brings everybody together.
Andrea Jenkins is a city council member-elect from Ward 8 on the Minneapolis City Council and the first African-American openly transgender woman elected to public office in the United States. Ms. Jenkins, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Todd.
Two high-profile Democratic lawmakers stand accused of sexual misconduct, and their party now is grappling with how to handle the allegations. Michigan Congressman John Conyers is the longest-serving member of the House. He's accused by several women of sexual harassment. Conyers stepped down from his spot leading Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, but he hasn't resigned, and as of now, his leadership hasn't asked him to. Then there's Minnesota Senator Al Franken responding Monday to allegations he groped four women, one while he was a sitting U.S. senator.
I am embarrassed. I feel ashamed. What I'm going to do is I'm going to start my job. I'm going to go back to work. I'm going to work as hard as I can for the people of Minnesota, and I'm going to start that right now.
Now, what you did not hear there is Senator Al Franken offering to resign. You also didn't hear his leadership trying to force him out. And some Democrats are now questioning whether their moral clarity on women's rights can be defended in a situation like this. I put that very question to Andrea Jenkins in Minneapolis just a minute ago, and I'll put it now to Marcy Stetch, a Democratic strategist also in Minnesota right now. Marcy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Let's listen to Nancy Pelosi on Meet the Press over the weekend talking about John Conyers from Michigan.
Just because someone is accused, and was it one accusation? Is it two? I think there has to be. John Conyers is an icon in our country.
Marcy, there was some apparent calculation in Nancy Pelosi's comments there on Sunday. A lot of Democrats didn't like what they heard. What did you hear?
I heard a response that missed the mark on many different levels. And I think that Nancy Pelosi and Democrats right now are grappling with the allegations on our side. We are very used to it on Republicans because Donald Trump is the sitting president of the United States. But I think we're seeing right now is Nancy Pelosi and leadership across our party who are trying to figure out the right way to handle these allegations, because with every industry right now, this is not the last shoe that's going to drop. And we have to have a very clear process in place. And I think that Nancy Pelosi needs to acknowledge that we need to do better. We didn't hear that from her, and I think we are hearing that from her and Democratic leadership now as they try to figure out how to chart this moving forward.
Well, Marcy, give us some insight into the calculations that may be going on here in the real world. Let's take the case of Al Franken, since you're in Minnesota. On the one hand, Franken's alleged behavior is serial, arguably unbecoming of a senator, definitely not consistent with a party that says it champions the rights of women. On the other hand, in the real world, Al Franken is a superstar in the Democratic Party. He raises a ton of money, which is important to get Democrats, including women, elected. This is politics, and these calculations are being made.
Sure. Well, assault and harassment is unexcusable from anyone in any context ever. And I think that what we're hearing from him and seeing in his response is that he has clearly acknowledged what he has done wrong and that he's willing to comply with an ethics investigation. And I think, you know, this is messy. This is not something that is going to be solved overnight. It is very clear that rules on Capitol Hill are antiquated, and those who are kind of perpetuating that system are a little bit concerned about how to move forward on this.
But Marcy, are you concerned, as so many other Democrats are right now, that calls for investigations, due process, as you said at the top, might miss the mark and might cede some of Democrats' moral clarity on defending the rights of women?
Look, I think that we are going to have to get to a place where Democrats can feel like the second anything should come out, any accusations, that they have a clear and swift process, whether it is suspension, whether it is straight to an ethics investigation, or whether it is clearly someone should step down without even that investigation. But right now, there is no process in place. And so getting that together will be fine. I think, you know, look, I think the case for electing women has never been stronger. You were just talking to Andrea Jenkins about this, but there are thousands of women who are coming forward and saying that they are ready to step up and run for office. I think that with more women, we will see less of this. But unfortunately, this is where we're grappling right now. And this is not going to be the last shoe to drop on either side of the aisle.
Democratic strategist Marcy Stetch, a veteran of Washington, currently in Minnesota. Marcy, thanks for being here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
In Baltimore, the murder of an on-duty police detective last week has raised new questions about an ongoing federal corruption case involving police officers in two cities. Veteran Baltimore detective Sean Souter was shot in the head last Wednesday after confronting a man he saw acting suspiciously. Here's Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis in a press conference on Thursday.
We remain dedicated and committed to finding the person who ended such a beautiful life, such a wonderful detective, husband, father, and friend. We will find the person responsible for this ridiculous, absurd, unnecessary loss of life.
The shooter has not yet been found. Meanwhile, the timing of the murder is suspicious. Souter died the day before he was set to testify before a federal grand jury investigating the same task force involved in the corruption trial. Justin Fenton is a reporter for the Baltimore Sun covering the Baltimore Police Department. Justin, welcome back to The Takeaway. First, remind people of the corruption investigation into former members of the gun task force. What are they being investigated for?
Earlier this year, seven members of an elite gun task force in the Baltimore Police Department were charged in a racketeering indictment. They're accused of robbing citizens, falsifying police reports, and earning fraudulent overtime. Subsequent to that, a former member of the squad has been indicted, and an officer from Philadelphia who used to work here has been accused of conspiring with them to resell drugs that were seized.
So it's a wide-ranging case. You were on the program last week talking about the scope of this investigation. Justin, what was Detective Souter's role in all this, or at least his connection to it, that had him testifying?
It was sort of a stunning combination of events. On one hand, you have this corruption scandal that is one of the biggest in the department's history, and then Detective Souter's killing is the first killing of an on-duty officer here in 10 years. The day before Thanksgiving, the police commissioner confirmed something that had been out in the community for a few days, which was that Detective Souter was scheduled to testify before a federal grand jury investigating that squad of officers. It's not entirely clear what he was going to testify to. We have connected it to a case from 2010 where he was working with one of the indicted officers, and they spotted somebody, boxed that person in with their vehicles, gave chase. The fleeing person, you know, hit a car and killed an 87-year-old man. And that person who fled was arrested for drugs and is spending 15 years in federal prison. So we're waiting for more details to come out about what exactly the detective's role in this was. But we do know that in police reports from that incident, he was reported as having found the drugs.
So apparently Detective Souter set to testify in a grand jury case dating back from 2010, which may be connected to the corruption trial going on right now.
Yeah, what we found was a case from 2010. He was scheduled to testify about that case. What exactly he was going to testify to is unclear.
And Justin, just to be clear, have police managed to connect Detective Souter's murder to the case in question?
So even though there's so much that is unknown about this case at this point, we're entering 2 weeks without an arrest, without even a suspect identified. They're trying to distance this killing from that case. They're saying that they believe from what they do know that the killing was spontaneous, and that they think that that lends credibility to the idea that this was no planned hit, as you know, people are speculating, but that it was just something that happened in the line of duty, and that it's nothing more than a coincidence.
And back on the corruption trial of these seven officers in two cities that you mentioned, where exactly does that trial stand now?
That trial is tentatively scheduled for January, but we do expect, because the grand jury is continuing to investigate claims, that there could be additional charges, and that sometimes has the effect of pushing things back. So we're in a wait-and-see mode right now.
An on-duty detective in Baltimore murdered on the job, and now investigators are looking for connections to an ongoing corruption case in Baltimore and Philadelphia. Justin Fenton with the Baltimore Sun, thanks again.
Okay, thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time. And Westridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, aspiring to help men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders with a family-centered integrated treatment approach. More at westbridge.org.
There is a war being waged on our police officers.
There's an oppressive force in the way that criminal justice engages with black bodies.
And it becomes unrepairable. It doesn't take a lot for things to spiral out of control.
Put their minds somewhat at ease when they're out here on the streets and not be so aggressive, because they're supposed to protect and serve, not kill us all.
They want to invite for coffee and dinner people who tweet out support of convicted cop killers.
Most of you guys don't know what it's like to be followed in the store for no reason, to be stopped and pulled over for no reason.
It's simply not going to end.
Thanks for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick, and let's go to Hartford, Connecticut now. Over the last several weeks, we've been speaking directly to police officers to get a sense of their lives and their concerns. It's all part of our series, To Serve and Protect, Life Behind the Blue Line. The police department in Hartford is taking an aggressive approach to transparency and accountability, and Brian Foley is part of it.
My name is Deputy Chief Brian Foley with the Hartford Police Department in Hartford, Connecticut. I've been here for 23 years. I was hired in 1994, started out as a patrolman. After about 8 years, I was put in the Detective Bureau Homicide Division. After that, I became a supervisor and was eventually put into the Internal Affairs Division. One of the few cops that you'll talk to that have arrested other police officers. Eventually, I was the commander of Internal Affairs. From there, I was put back on the street again on our Frog Hollow, our largely Latino community. probably my favorite assignment. And then after that, I was back in major crimes, homicide. And then shortly thereafter that, I got promoted to deputy chief. It's been frustrating more recently the way media's covered police over the last 4 or 5 years on a national level. I've watched media eviscerate politicians, eviscerate administrations here in the police department. Our police department had tumultuous relationships with media for the most part of my career, the beginning part of my career. So about 5 years ago, when approached, I couldn't wait for the opportunity to represent our police department and start working on a true communication strategy to give people an honest look at what happens at our police department here in the city of Hartford and an honest look at the great work that the women and men of our police department do. You know, everyone judges people, unfortunately, by the roles that they're in. All doctors right now are under the spotlight for prescribing meds. When doctors in Florida are over-prescribing meds, you know, people think that doctors back here in Connecticut are doing the same thing. And for police officers, it's worse. And it's such a wide variety of police officers and police philosophies. You know, you're going to have a lot of variations. And unfortunately, people that are outside of law enforcement don't realize that and kind of just clump us all together. We were in the unfortunate or fortunate position here in Hartford to watch how other police departments made mistakes communication-wise nationally. Look at what the police departments put out after there's a police shooting. Probably the most critical time for police communications to exist and be strong. And you've watched police communications falter. You're waiting a week before you find out the names of the officers involved. You're waiting days after events and weeks and months before you really start to learn what really happened. Here in the city of Hartford, we've done that drastically different. When we've had bad incidents, we are out in front of it. We had a police shooting here. Within 12 hours, we had put out the officers' names, rank, internal affairs histories. We played the audio from the incident, showed pictures from the incident, and tried to get as much out there as possible. We've been so transparent and so honest. Problem is, the frustration comes at a national level, both in big media and then social media and small media. You know, when a cop screws up 2,000 miles away in some small town in Ohio that we've never heard of, it reflects badly on us here. Bad things are happening nationally, but look at all the great stuff that's going on in your own city is what we're trying to tell everybody. You look at how transparent we are. We talk about the bad things that happen in our city and the violence that happens in our city. You can bet two towns away in some of the richest suburbs in this country, if something violent happens in their town, they'd like to keep that as quiet as possible. The problem is, when you do that, you're not building transparency. And you need to have a good record of transparency, not when something bad happens, but, you know, years and years and years in advance. And that's an infrastructure that a police department needs to build. And it starts at the top and with the top's philosophy and how they're going to approach transparency. As police officers, geez, for 100 years, we've been our own worst enemy. When you see police officers talk on TV, how they usually dressed. They're in a uniform, their hat's screwed down over their nose, they're talking in a military tone, they're putting out as little information as possible. It doesn't cast us as human beings, it casts us as these military soldiers. And think about what the uniform means. You know, maybe the uniform to me means pride and respect and dignity, you know, but you know, you drive two blocks north from our police station and the uniform means a whole lot of other things. It means racism, systemic bias, police brutality. You got people that lived through the riots in the 60s here in the city of Hartford that don't exactly love the police uniform. They don't exactly love police dogs, and they don't like cops walking around with rifles. And when you have to understand that when you're putting your message out there, who you're talking to and who you're trying to build trust with. You know, you're not going to have communication without trust. What have you done to build trust prior to something bad happening? Something bad's going to happen. You know, at some point in every city in this country, a cop's going to shoot somebody. And it's how are you prepared for that when it does happen? Are you going to hide things? You know, are you going to be transparent? Are you going to be open to your community? On our last police shooting, we called community members, some of our neighborhood leaders and some of our faith-based people. We called them down to the scene as it was happening. You know, that's the kind of trust you need from your people in your community and your city when something bad does happen. How are you prepared to deal with it when it does? Look at social media. Go to some of your big national police departments and look at their social media pages. See if they put up mugshots. If a police department's putting up a mugshot, what is that? That's really a trophy shot. It's like shooting a deer and hanging the head on your wall. You look at some police departments, and I hate to pick on Baltimore, just go to Baltimore's website and look at the pictures of their mugshots. What do all the mugshots look like? You know, you'll go 10, 12 brown people in a row. before you find somebody, a white person on there. So what's Baltimore saying? What are police departments saying? We arrest brown people. That's what we do. And you're putting their mugshot out there. And now you've upset that person's family, and that person's friends, most likely the whole neighborhood, or anyone that has a positive relationship with that person's mugshot who's up there. And now you talk about reentry. That person has to come out of jail at some point. And when he does, his picture's on your website or on your social media page. And when he's trying to get a job, an employer's going to search it, and that's where they're going to find it. That's damaging. In some way, we've been our own worst enemy. I don't think it's fair. I certainly don't think that the national dialogue about how police officers are is fair. But again, communication-wise, across the country for the last 50 to 100 years, we've been our own worst enemy. And our marketing certainly and needs to change.
That was Deputy Chief Brian Foley of the Hartford Police Department. And if you're in law enforcement and would like to speak with us, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering technology solutions for businesses, from laptops and tablets to smartphones, and including tech services like setup, repair, and tech security. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
Welcome back. Thanks for being with us here on The Takeaway today. I'm Todd Zwillick, and we're now just 2 weeks out from the Alabama special election between Republican Roy Moore and Democrat Doug Jones. They're competing to fill Jeff Sessions' vacated Senate seat. But a cloud of harassment and assault allegations still hangs over Roy Moore's campaign, with very young women and a child, a girl of 14, at its center.
I have a special concern for protection of young ladies. These allegations are just completely false.
That's Roy Moore defending himself earlier this month to Sean Hannity on Fox News. Now, Moore continued to deny all wrongdoing against teenage women and girls, even as allegations kept coming out following that interview that you just heard a clip of. Today, one sexual harassment law expert says the alleged actions of Roy Moore are an example of why consent laws meant to protect minors from adult predators need to change.
As they're growing, we need to give them decision-making opportunities, but we need to protect them from predators, people who would take advantage of their maturing phase and would get them to consent when they really don't know what's going on.
That's Jennifer Drobeck. She's a professor of sexual harassment law at Indiana University, also author of Sexual Exploitation of Teenagers, Adolescent Development, Discrimination, and Consent Law. And Jennifer Drobeck says that changing consent laws could protect teens legally and could keep men from going after them in the first place.
Consent laws specify an age at which a juvenile can consent legally to sex with another person. And a lot of these laws, well, they vary in the age range that they set, depending on the behavior, depending on who the partner is, whether that person is an adult and a teacher, whether or not there's an age difference between the two parties. So there's a great deal of variety between these state laws. My point is that the brain science, neuroscience, and psychosocial evidence tells us that juvenile brains are not the same as adults. And while they can make decisions similar to adults in cool, calm, regulated situations, when they're in hot situations, situations that are new, that they haven't encountered before, they tend to make decisions differently than do adults, and they tend to favor risk and short-term reward over long-term consequences. And this can be really dangerous for teenagers when it comes to a decision to have sexual relations with an adult.
So talk a little bit more about the brain science, about the neuroscience here of the teenage brain, and how that informs the way you think consent laws need to change.
We know that the brain undergoes a massive blooming of gray matter cells at puberty. And these cells perform a variety of functions, but the brain tends to develop beginning in puberty from the back of the brain to the front of the brain and reorganizes itself, if you will. And the front of the brain, the area that comes online latest, That's the prefrontal cortex. That's the area of sober second thought and the area of decision making. And so just when we're saying that these teens are ready to consent to sex, their brains are rewiring, if you will. So there are two different kinds of consent. There's actual consent and legal consent. Actual consent is when you nod and say yes. Legal consent presumes legal capacity, an ability to understand the nature, the extent, and the results of your behavior. And so part of the argument is that because these teen brains are developing, they may not be giving legal consent, even though the law says they may have legal capacity.
Well, Jennifer, in this critique of consent and legal consent on the part of minors, even adolescents, you talk about a new standard. You call it assent, which is different from consent. Explain what you think assent should mean in this context.
Assent means that a minor agrees to something, goes along with something. But assent does not carry a presumption of legal capacity. And the beauty of this idea is it's not really new. It's paralleled to current contract law, which has been in effect for hundreds of years. And that is, juveniles can make contracts, but contracts are voidable by the minors. So in essence, the minors are giving assent. But if they discover that someone's taken advantage of them, they can void their assent and they can basically undo the contract without consequences. So what I'm suggesting is that we borrow from traditional contract law and say minors can assent to sex with an adult, but during their minority, that is while they're still a child or a teen, they can withdraw the consent, which means that the adult risks prosecution for statutory rape. So that causes a chill. It basically says to that 28-year-old, do you really want to have sex with someone who's still a legal minor? So instead of telling the children to just say no, I'm telling the adults, just say no. And in fact, it's not even a no, it's a wait. Wait a couple of years until she's an adult. You don't have to be having sex with a child or someone whose brain is still developing.
A lot of people might look at this proposal and say, why not simply raise the age of consent itself, or maybe lower the age of the person who can legally have sex with someone under a certain age? For instance, 32 is not allowed, 22 maybe would be allowed. Can you narrow the age gap between the two parties and potentially reduce the chances of coercion?
That's a possibility, but here's my concern. I don't want to sweep in Romeo and Juliet or Romeo and Romeo high school lovers into this legal net. Children need maturing experiences. And as human beings, we're born sexual beings. And so it's natural for us in age-appropriate ways to explore our sexuality. And my concern with raising the age of consent across the board without any kind of nuance is that we deny children the opportunity to explore their own sexuality with their peers in age-appropriate ways because they fear risk of prosecution because of these high age of consent laws.
Jennifer, let's step outside the law for one moment and talk about the culture. When you look at the case of Roy Moore and his alleged behavior with a 14-year-old girl when he was 32, a lot of this is politics, and I get that. But in the aftermath, you've seen a lot of people, friends of his in Alabama, say, even if this is true, I have no problem with this behavior. Roy Moore did nothing wrong. When you hear people say that, what do you think?
I wonder how they would feel if it were their daughter that was groped or molested by an adult male, who's charged with being an officer of the court and upholding the law, how they would feel if it were their sister or their mother. I just don't understand this. It's a job of every parent to guide, inform, and protect our children. And if it's true that Roy Moore molested a 14-year-old, not only is he a pedophile, but he also, at that time, broke the law because the age of consent in Alabama is 16. And that's a serious concern if this is someone who is charged with upholding the law, has sworn an oath to do that, and is now running for Senate. I find that shocking.
Jennifer Drobak is professor of sexual harassment law at Indiana University and author of Sexual Exploitation of Teenagers, Adolescent Development, Discrimination, and Consent Law. Professor Drobak, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We want your reaction to Jennifer Drobak's proposal. Should we change the rules of consent? Let teenagers give voidable assent? How do you think the system would work best to protect young people? Join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can always call and leave a message with your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Meanwhile, we're still hearing from you about where you want to see your political party in 20 years.
My name is Joanna, and I'm calling from Windham, New Hampshire. I am a registered independent, and I really hope that we can all come together and really move towards progress for the nation and not so much for corporations and the 1%.
What issues do you want to define your party in the next 20 years? We're looking at that all this week and next week as we look at the Republicans and the Democrats. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Republicans, don't forget, we're talking about the future of your party next week, and we definitely want to hear from you. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.